Welcome to this episode of On The Case, the LSE Law Society's podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Tan. In each episode, we speak to various professionals and experts to gain insight into legal careers, law school, and other exciting developments in the world of law. Without further ado, sit back and enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of LSE's On The Case. Our guest today is Professor Trudeau Lemons. Professor Lemons is currently a professor and show chair in health law and policy at the University of Toronto, with cross appointments in the Dalhousie School of Public Health and the Joint Centre for Bioethics. He is also a member of two expert panels of the Council of Canadian Academies, one on access to health data and the other on advance requests and medical assistance dying. Thank you so much for coming onto our podcast today. To start our discussion off, could you please provide our listeners with a brief introduction of who you are and your academic career?
Yes, thank you for having me on this important topic that certainly is also in England quite topical and quite in the news, as I know. So I am a professor of law and bioethics. I teach courses in health law, mental health and the law. Research ethics. I've taught courses on privacy law in the past. I've taught intensive courses also on end-of-life related issues and the law. And I worked for assisted dying for quite some time. So I'm originally from Belgium, Dutch-speaking, which allowed me to follow in quite some detail the euthanasia developments, the legalization of euthanasia in Belgium and the Netherlands, and to participate in the Canadian debate from that perspective, informed by my study of Belgian and Dutch regimes. And so, as you pointed out, I was a member of an expert panel on medical assistance in dying set up by the Council of Canadian Academies. I was also an expert witness for the government in two constitutional cases in which the first legal bill on medical assistance in dying was legalized in Canada. And I participated in parliamentary committees as an expert witness. Also actually testified before the Jersey Citizens Jury and closer to your home.
Let's dive into the topic that we are to discuss today, which would be euthanasia. For the listeners that do not currently study or have extensive knowledge about this topic, could you please explain what active or passive euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide is?
Yes, so the term passive euthanasia is I would say, no longer so much used anymore, but active euthanasia refers to the ending of life by a lethal injection by a physician. In Canada, it can actually also be a nurse practitioner, whereas passive euthanasia is more the withholding or withdrawing of life support, which has been legal in most or in many jurisdictions around the world for quite some time. So there's a fundamental difference between the two in the sense that there is an active injection of a lethal dose, a lethal medication by physicians in the context of euthanasia. Assisted suicide is a practice of prescribing or providing the means to have the person end their life themselves. So generally occurs with the prescription of medication. It's a practice that has been legalized in several US states, in New Zealand, and also in Australia. And so euthanasia is the practice that in Canada, we use the term, and it was introduced by legislation of medical assistance in dying, which is actually encompassing both euthanasia and assisted suicide. But what we see in regimes that have introduced a combination of the two, all of the practices involve lethal injection by physicians. So in Canada, it's in 2021, for example, we had only 7 out of 10, more than 10,000 cases of assisted suicide. So all of the cases nearly were euthanasia cases, injection by lethal medication by a physician.
Are there any key cases or landmark cases that you would like to share with us regarding this?
Yes, so in Canada, there are not so many jurisdictions around the world that actually have had constitutional decisions that declare that an absolute prohibition on physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia or assisted dying, as it's called in Canada, are unconstitutional. But there are a couple. And so Canada was one of the first countries after Colombia in Latin America, to declare that an absolute prohibition, where the Supreme Court declared that an absolute prohibition on physician-assisted dying was unconstitutional. And so that was a leading case in Canada, where the government was given, Parliament was given 1 year to change the legislation to allow some form of assisted dying. And one of the discussions in the Canadian context was, is how much leeway did the legislator have in changing the law to address that Supreme Court ruling. So first legislation that was enacted in Canada restricted or introduced as an essential safeguard that physician-assisted dying or medical-assisted dying would only be provided to people who had a reasonable foreseeable natural death, which was a very legalistic term that basically captured the broad end-of-life context. And this safeguard, which other people felt was an inappropriate restriction, was again challenged in court. And we had one lower court, first instance court in Quebec, declaring that that the restriction to reasonable foreseeable natural death was discriminatory and inappropriately infringed the right to life, liberty, and security of the person of two plaintiffs who were people who arguably did not have access to MAID yet at the time when they were asking the court to side with them. And so the court basically declared that this restriction to reasonable foreseeable natural death was unconstitutional. And the decision was never appealed. And the parliament, with particularly under impetus of a minister of justice who was very supportive of broadening the law, which basically broadened the legislation and reduced also other safeguards in the law to broaden medical assistance in dying in the country.
Could you please tell us what your opinion on euthanasia is and what are some classic arguments that you would normally use for euthanasia?
So I came to defend, after the Supreme Court ruled that we needed to have some form of access to medical assistance in dying, I came to defend, also as an expert witness in court, the first Canadian bill that allowed medical assistance in dying, as they call it in Canada, also so in the broad end-of-life context. This was partly because I felt, you know, the Supreme Court has ruled on this. For some people, it seems very reassuring, particularly people who have a degenerative disease. It seems very reassuring to be able to have the means to see their transition between life and death eased by physicians in cases they would be suffering intolerably. And so I defended the law, although I was not completely convinced, and this is reflected in my earlier writing, of its absolute necessity. I often think that people overstate the need for that, often romanticize or portray physician-assisted dying and euthanasia and assisted suicide as inherently more dignifying. And I think there are various ways in which we have improved end-of-life care already outside that context. But still, I defended the law. So I defended the legalization, but have become since then very concerned about how the practice has very rapidly expanded in the Canadian context. So how advocates for medical assistance in dying have pushed to broaden the procedure as some form of to doing something. I have become concerned about how advocates for euthanasia and assisted suicide have really pushed for a normalization of the ending of life by physicians as a form of therapy in all kinds of circumstances outside of the end of life context, particularly in the context of persons being faced with a disability or a chronic illness, where we often have a too easy judgment about the quality of life of people in that condition. And so my thinking over time has changed, and I'm particularly concerned about how the system has developed in Canada, which I think should be a warning sign for other countries that are contemplating and are discussing some form of legalization of medical assistance in dying or physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. What the arguments in favor of euthanasia, legalizing euthanasia and assisted suicide have been is, it's often a combination of things. It's rarely just liberty. because if you talk about liberty, people having the freedom to decide what they want for themselves, you can actually think that it might justify the prescription of legal medication so that people have access to legal medication, but it actually makes it much harder to argue that physicians should be involved in that, that you should organize a system of government-funded and medical system-provided ending of life. You can, I think, a liberty argument may justify the provision of lethal medication so that people can do things for themselves. But as soon as you start talking about physicians getting involved, actually, you see that in the regimes that introduce that, it's always a combination of providing compassion and care of people who are in the context of the healthcare context suffering and who want to have relief of suffering. And the physician involvement is then justified on the basis of some form of duty to relieve suffering of people who are in that particular condition. So it combines the idea that people should be able to choose how they want to have their suffering relieved, and then a duty of physicians to help relieve that suffering, even by actively ending the life of patients. So that's the combination that you often see in defense of legalization of assisted suicide in euthanasia.
This leads on to the next question. What are the arguments that one would use to counter the use of euthanasia?
I think there are many arguments which go from rejecting completely the legalization of assisted suicide in euthanasia to, I would say, sending a warning sign about how this has to be designed, how a system of legalized euthanasia and assisted suicide has to be very carefully crafted that it actually doesn't lead to abuse. So in general, I would say the arguments from a more fundamental perspective to a kind of more safeguards perspective are, first of all, human life matters. We need to offer protection. So the state has a duty to offer protection against the death of persons. We see that reflected in arguments around around the death penalty as well, namely arguments about the inherent value of human life. And human life, the right to life, is a fundamental human right, is one of the most, if not the most crucial human rights. So if you take this value very seriously, any exception to the duty to protect life has to be carefully crafted in terms of, it may be justified because of self-defense, but when you start making exceptions for, oh, you know, it has to be allowed in terms of relief of suffering, people will express concern about what does it exactly mean? How can we confine that? What will it mean if we allow the state actually to support ending of life in specific circumstances? So it's a kind of a transgression of a line, I think, is the most inherent argument against legalization of assisted suicide and euthanasia. Also, in connection with that, arguments about we are committed to suicide prevention. Suicide is obviously no longer considered a criminal offense because we consider it more, and appropriately so, an act that happens in moments of despair. So, but still, we recognize even though there can be arguments about rational suicide, that in general, suicide is something that we the state aims to prevent, that is approached from a healthcare perspective as something that has to be provided. So I would say these core arguments are the strongest arguments to support a kind of a full prohibition on assisted suicide and euthanasia. There are other broader arguments that where questions can be asked about what does that mean? So how can we deal with these concerns? Does it mean that we have to have an absolute prohibition, or can we provide strict safeguards or strict restrictions that actually address some of that concern? One of the broadest concerns, I would say, that I certainly see coming out from the experience in Belgium, the Netherlands, and in Canada, and particularly in regimes that have legalized the medical provider ending of life, so by physicians or nurse practitioners in Canada, is the fact that when we introduce a system like that, we normalize the ending of life, and we thereby devalue the lives of, or we tend to devalue as a, in the context of the normalization of ending of life, of the persons who are targeted by these measures. Namely, we start applying it, and we've seen that in the Belgian and the Dutch and the Canadian context already, we start saying that, well, when people have a certain age, it's an appropriate thing to relieve their suffering for a variety of ailments. We start potentially seeing devaluing when we go certainly also outside of the end of life context of the life of persons with disabilities, of patients with chronic illnesses. There's some evidence and growing body of evidence to suggest that that's a concern. So for example, Belgium and the Netherlands started off having a more limited practice of end of life, even though they always allowed euthanasia and assist suicide outside of the end of life context. They started with a practice that primarily focused on people who were terminally ill, who were approaching their natural death, but they gradually started to apply it in the broader context. In Belgium, the Federal Control Commission that has a review function and that actually looks at or assesses all of the cases that have been declared by physicians as being a euthanasia-assisted suicide cases, started introducing and accepting actually the concept of polypathology as a legitimate basis for physicians to end the life of patients. And what is polypathology? If you look at the annual reports in Belgium, it's a very broad concept that reflects a combination of ailments that are often associated with old age. And commentators in Belgium have rightly argued that it actually suggests a medicalization of old age and a normalization of an approach of ending of life of people who are elderly, who suffer from combination of severe hearing loss, problems with mobility, problems of vision loss, incontinency, and then more serious conditions such as heart conditions, problems with breathing, and so on. So if you look at the description of what they started considering appropriate as a reason for physicians to, obviously with consent, I mean, that's in the Belgian law, when you see what they started to allow, it actually broadened the category of people who were given a life-ending procedure by physicians. So in the Canadian context, and we can come back to that in, with further questions that you may have, we started seeing in the last couple of years, so we had legalization of assisted suicide and euthanasia only since 2016, but we started already in a very short period of time that it has been legalized. We see people asking for medical assistance in dying because they fear that they will become homeless and they are suffering from, they are struggling with a chronic illness and fear that when they become homeless, when they lose their home, they will no longer be able to really have an adequate quality of life in connection with the chronic condition that they have. We see people asking for medical assistance in dying, as they term it in Canada, because they are suffering from a chemical sensitivity and don't have access to adequate housing in the system. So these are case reports that came out as a result of fact-checked media accounts, and so they hint at an expansion and a normalization of medical assistance in dying for broad social context-induced suffering. So I would say that's the kind of the second concern is. So I talked about the big concern human life matters, like the inherent dignity, the inherent value of life, then the concern about normalization and expanding of the practice. Connected to the concern about expansion is also the risk for abuse. The fact that, and I would say this is often undervalued. So we often have, I think, in debates around legalization of euthanasia and assisted suicide, somewhat of a romanticization of the inherent commitment of physicians and healthcare providers. Yes, the majority of physicians and healthcare providers are committed to helping patients, but there is abuse in any area, in any context of the practice of medicine. Here we will introduce a practice whereby physicians are given the ultimate power, whereby people's lives are ended. The person who will have their life ended is no longer there to testify about what exactly happened, what are the circumstances in which the person died. So from the perspective of the risk for abuse, it will be much more difficult actually to find fault for the type of abuse that can take place. And physicians, family members are human. These practices occur in circumstances that are challenging, where sometimes family members give up on the care for patients, where physicians may be under pressure, may be feel fed up with situations. So there is a human factor there that we have to take into consideration when we think about what we should allow doctors to do. We see in countries that have legalized the practice that cases very rarely go to court. You can count the cases that where there was actually legal action and legal scrutiny less than one hand. So Belgium had, I would say, one case that went all the way up to a criminal review, criminal court case. And then we had a case that was actually stalled before it went to court. In the Netherlands, we had, again, only a couple of cases that went to court where there was a review of the practice. Does that mean that there are many more? I would say we don't really know. It's very hard to kind of know how much, let's say, how many errors and how many potential abuses there are within the system, again, for the reasons that I already pointed out. A last factor, and I mean, you see that I mention a lot of factors of concern, but I think they're interrelated. Another concern that I have is that we see, and I certainly witnessed that strongly in the Canadian context, less so in Belgium and Netherlands, perhaps, although there is some shift there as well. Certainly in the Canadian context, there has been a fundamental shift in a very short period of time in how people have conceived the limits and the goal of and the role of physicians in the context of suffering and end of life. And I'm particularly concerned there about the fact that there is something inherently tempting about selling ending of life as a medical procedure. Medicine and physicians and the healthcare providers in general like to be able to offer solutions to patients. So it's an inherent part of the drive of being involved with patients that we try to help them. Now, if you sell ending of life as a solution to a nearly universal solution to all forms of suffering, it's always 100% effective. And so when a discourse developed around that, you see, I would say, a lack of humility among healthcare providers, some health professions organizations, in terms of realizing that ending of life can never be a pure beneficial practice. It's ending of a person's life. In terms of when you think about what will benefit a patient, priority should always be to try to improve their condition. And indeed, in some cases, it's valuable to stop every form of treatment and to compassionately accompany the person towards their death. But once you start using the ending of life, the active ending of life as a solution, and you start also providing that even outside of the end of life context, it becomes very tempting to start promoting that in situations where medicine may not necessarily have an immediate solution, but where where all kinds of measures, social support measures, disability support measures, accommodations, should be given priority in terms of trying to help the person to come around and find new, renewed hope in life.
How have the opinions of people with religious backgrounds changed throughout the years? And are there any prominent or particular reasons for this?
It's a good question. I'm not so familiar with the studies that have looked in detail at how people with religious backgrounds have changed in their opinion about legalization of assisted suicide or euthanasia. But it's clear that in some religions, there has been a movement towards an acceptance of some form of assisted suicide or euthanasia as a legitimate tool to help people with their relief of suffering. So in the Canadian context, I know that there are some Protestant churches that have come out in favor of the practice. Other churches have taken an approach that they actually no longer want to make an explicit statement about it. So they remain somewhat neutral. Again, I'm not so familiar with what the Jewish organizations take as a position. Yeah, it's a little bit of a difficult question for me, but so there has been some changes in some with people with who come at this from a religious perspective. It's fair to say that in some churches, for example, the Catholic Church remains strongly opposed, but it doesn't mean that there are no people who are somewhat supportive. So the practice relatively widespread in Belgium and Netherlands. I don't know the statistics about who accesses it and how many, say, even persons with Catholic background do use medical assistance in dying, but there are certainly some.
Thank you. So Professor Lemons, you have been in Canada, and recently Canada has delayed assisted dying for people that have mental illness. For those of our listeners who are not based in Canada, could you explain what's happening and what your thoughts are regarding this issue, please?
To explain what has happened in the Canadian context, I have to go back to the 2015 Supreme Court decision in the Carter case, where the Supreme Court declared that an absolute prohibition on medical assistance in dying was unconstitutional. And so from that day on, advocates for a broad access to medical assistance in dying argued that it had to be widely available for everyone who suffered intolerably from a medical condition and who had a irreversible decline of capability. And the first law that was introduced in 2016 restricted the law to the reasonable, foreseeable death context, so in the broad end of life context. And so people with mental illness were never excluded, but could only have access when they had a condition that led actually to a reasonable, foreseeable, natural death. So arguably when they were approaching their death because of other reasons, because mental illness in and of itself is not a fatal condition. People live with mental health conditions for decades. So when a lower court decision in Quebec declared that the restriction to the end of life context was unconstitutional, the government developed a new bill, which introduced medical assistance in dying outside of the end of life context, but the government actually explicitly excluded from the bill mental illness because it felt that providing death to people as a therapy for or as a solution for mental illness was complex, raised various issues around the challenge of determining the irremediability of mental illness, which is actually not a scientific thing to do. We don't know who will never get better in the context of mental illness. And so the government said it would not commit to providing in law access to ending of life by physicians for mental illness. But when the Senate, so the second house of parliament, debated the bill, they actually voted in favor of adding a mental illness to the original law, but stating that mental illness would only be introduced within 1 year after the enactment of the law. So they gave basically the government 1 year to implement guidelines for allowing mental illness as a basis for euthanasia and or assisted suicide. Many people opposed the expansion outside of the end of life context. So it's important to emphasize that in Canada, about all disability rights organizations were very upset about the fact that the euthanasia and assisted suicide was now offered, particularly for them. And so to people with disabilities, including people with mental disabilities. In other words, suicide prevention would no longer be the focus for them. Other people who don't suffer from a disability or from a mental illness would still be offered suicide prevention if they would say that they want to have their life ended. But persons with disabilities were now, by law, allowed to have access to medical assistance in dying. And so they certainly also opposed the inclusion, the future inclusion, which would have happened in March of this year for mental illness as a basis for euthanasia. There was particular concern among mental health care providers also about the provision of euthanasia for persons with mental illness. And a federal committee was set up to look at the implementation of the new bill for persons with mental illness. But the committee itself, I would say, had serious challenges because two members of the committee resigned before it actually issued its recommendations. And it didn't provide any strong recommendations to strengthen the review for applications of medical assistance in dying. At the same time, chairs of psychiatry of all medical schools in Canada wrote a letter to the government basically expressing serious concern, saying that there was no scientific basis to predict the irremediability of mental illness, and that therefore we would be offering that as a solution to people who are suffering from mental illness, whereas we don't know who of them would never get better. We actually know that most people with good quality mental health care will improve and will actually find a way to deal with their mental illness, and particularly if you take a recovery approach to mental illness, would learn how to live with the components of mental illness that cause suffering. But we actually don't, yes, there are some people who may not be benefit from various forms of treatment, but we actually don't know who will not benefit. And so they wrote a letter to the government saying that the implementation of MAID for Mental Illness in March 2023 was hugely problematic. And so the government, under pressure of the media and advocacy groups and the mental health providers, delayed for another year the implementation of MAID for Mental Illness. So at this point, it will happen, but it's actually suspended to March of 2024.
Outside the context of people that have mental illnesses, do you think the existing laws and policies that Canada has will need to undergo reform? And would you suggest these reforms to all countries?
So yes, there are serious concerns about what is happening in the Canadian context, particularly since the expansion of the medical assistance in dying law in Canada. Disability rights organizations, social justice advocates, academics, legal academics, bioethicists and others have expressed concern. I mean, there are people who are strongly defending the expansion outside of the end-of-life context as well, but these disability rights organizations and three United Nations special rapporteurs on human rights have expressed concern that offering the ending of life by physicians outside of the end-of-life context puts the lives and security of persons with disabilities at risk. So it's basically sending the message that if you are not dying, but you have a disability, whether it's a physical disability or a mental disability, even if you're not dying, that is an appropriate remedy that should be offered by the system. In other words, if you have a disability and a mental illness, only you, and not a person who is not dealing with the same issues, will be told by the state now in Canada, is being told by the state now in Canada, that the ending of life is an appropriate solution, and that your life, your quality of life is such that indeed it's an appropriate thing for the state to offer the ending of life as a means out of that form of life. And so that fundamentally sends the message that a life with a disability is less worth living. So that's a serious concern from a disability rights perspective. We also see in the Canadian context that people are concretely now opting for medical assistance in dying, for euthanasia, and particularly when they explicitly state, I would want to continue to live, but the healthcare system is not providing me with the means to have a dignified life, or I actually am lacking the social support. I risk becoming homeless, and I see no other solution than actually having my life ended. And so there are serious concerns that the ending of life, the normalization of ending of life, sends the message that this is an appropriate remedy. It actually also removes the strong social justice obligation, or it actually removes incentives for the state to address in a more expensive and a more complex way the reasons why persons with disabilities and persons with chronic illness and persons with mental illness are suffering outside of the end-of-life context. So we see a normalization of ending of life, which will always be cheaper as a method than addressing shortcomings in the healthcare system, so shortcomings in the social support system. And so the kind of the messaging that is sent by the legalization concretely already saves costs within the healthcare system, and in my view, has already led to a devaluing of the value of the lives of persons and the of persons with disabilities and chronic illness, removing the incentive actually to provide other means to support their life with dignity.
Professor Lemons, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. It was a huge pleasure, and I hope you have a great day. Thank you for coming.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning into this episode of On the Case, the LSC Law Society's podcast. Further information and our contact details can be found in the description of this episode. Don't forget to follow us at LSCSU Law Soc on Instagram or on LinkedIn at LSC's On the Case. See you next time!